Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. On a day when the European Parliament declared natural gas and nuclear energy officially green and eligible for cheaper loans and government subsidies, therefore, to help the continent toward a low-carbon future. Are nuclear energy and natural gas green? That debate reached a new level of relevance in Europe today. It's a day on which President Biden is contemplating what to do after getting a handwritten letter from WNBA star Brittany Griner from her prison in Russia. The possible greatest of all time in women's basketball is on trial there merely for possessing some cannabis oil in a vaping cartridge, it's been reported. And the world is asking, would we have allowed them to hold LeBron James or any other male sports superstar this long for the same charge without forcing some kind of a prisoner exchange or something? It's a week when ultra-right Congresswoman Lauren Boebert of Colorado tweeted about a mass shooting in Denmark to proclaim that gun laws are irrelevant to gun deaths, since Denmark has strict gun laws. Her tweet came on Sunday, which was July 3rd, the day before the July 4th parade massacre in Highland Park, Illinois. Now, in response to Boebert's tweet, global affairs expert Ian Bremmer tweeted out a chart showing the comparative rates of death from gun violence between the United States and Denmark. Reading that chart, it looks like ours is about 20 times higher than theirs. So there, in a nutshell, is perhaps a good example of the difference between a fact and the truth, certainly on social media. A fact is that Denmark had a mass shooting despite its tight gun laws. The truth is that the U.S. has a 20 times higher rate of death by gun in our gun-saturated nation. Ian Bremmer, who served up that piece of context, will join us in a minute with his new best-selling book that's not about guns and is actually optimistic on this 4th of July week when many of you may not be. It's a day after Gothamist published a story revealing that New York City quietly closed half its COVID-19 testing sites as Omicron rebounded this spring, and they remain closed, apparently, as the latest Omicron variant is beginning to spread. But it's a day on which, if you woke up fretting about any of the biggest crises facing your city or your world, maybe it's good to know that Ian Bremmer's new book about the power of crisis to bring positive change has hit the New York Times bestseller list. The book is called The Power of Crisis: How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World. And it's the threats I just referenced with those news stories: climate change, pandemics, and disruptive technology like social media. Ian also tweets, I hope this book calms some anxiety over the biggest threats of our time with a roadmap of how to build a better world. Let's see what's on that map. Ian, it's always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, it is always good to be with you.
Let's talk about some of this news as a way into your thesis. You watch Lauren Boebert's Twitter feed?
I wouldn't say I watch her Twitter feed, but of course, I do follow a number of people that are occasionally engaged with her or incensed by her, and that's how I saw that post.
What spurred you to find that chart about comparative rates of death by gun in industrially developed countries?
Because I compare the United States to other countries around the world all the time. I mean, there are some things that we perform comparatively well at, entrepreneurship, for example. There are other things that we perform comparatively abysmally at, and one of them is gun violence. And so when Lauren decided to post that purely context-free, yes, there was a shooting in Denmark and they're a disaster. I mean, anyone that covers Europe understands that we have a very different perspective on these things and a very different legal environment. So, I mean, I didn't go after her particularly. All I did was say, here's some context and make of it what you will. And apparently a lot of people wanted to see that.
For you as a global affairs expert, how do people in Europe or Japan or Russia and China, for that matter, see our unique rates of gun ownership and gun violence? And does it matter in a bigger way to the U.S.'s aspirations to continued global leadership on various things?
It does, Brian. I was just in Japan last week, and I will tell you that I've been going for 20 years, and this was my first trip there since the pandemic. And I would say that in every single meeting I had with government leaders, with industry leaders, with the media, they were asking me, what's happening in your country? They're concerned. And they're concerned in a very self-interested way, right? They're concerned because they worry that the United States might not be as consistent a leader for them, an ally for them, a security umbrella for them. I spoke with a couple of senators just when I got back who had been in Madrid for the NATO summit, telling me the same thing, that on the sidelines of the NATO summit, they were the big topic of conversation was not the was Trump an anomaly? What happens if he comes back a second term, which a lot of them were asked a year ago, but instead was much more broadly, is your democracy going to continue to stand up? Are you going to be capable of governing the way you have historically? There's deep-seated concern because our allies are seeing things happen in the United States that literally could not happen in their own countries. And so they're having a hard time processing it, assessing it.
So the state of our democracy intersects with guns, with climate, with all kinds of things. And I actually used the Lauren Boebert tweet as an example of one of your big three crises in the book that you hope will spur the world to positive transformation, the crisis of disruptive technology, like how social media probably delivered Lauren Boebert's misleading fact to many more people than your clarifying tweet. So what's the big disruptive technology picture that you write about?
Well, hopefully not so many more people. And I mean, one of the reasons why I try to use my platform in that way is because a lot of people in the United States and around the world do engage with it. So it does matter.
I don't mean to diminish your reach on social media.
No. You and I love each other, Brian. There's no problem there. But you're right that there is an issue. And I look at this a little more broadly. So rather than just take social media, let's look at all of the new technologies that have the potential to truly damage the global economy, our civil society, and the order, the geopolitical order that exists today. Because when you and I were kids, we had such a technology that we were very worried about. It was nuclear weapons. And I remember in high school when I watched The Day After, right, which was all about nuclear Armageddon from the perspective of Lawrence, Kansas. And I had nightmares, honestly, for months after that. And so did a lot of kids. And I remember that, you know, not just the United States, but even with the Soviets, it was the one thing that we tried to engage on because we were concerned that we could actually blow up the planet. We could damage our civilization because of these incredibly dangerous technologies. So we needed to constrain them and we needed to stop other countries and stop non-state actors, stop terrorists from getting their hands on nukes. And over the last 80 years, we had some failures, but generally speaking, our record has been pretty good. Well, in the 21st century, we're today looking at a whole new range of dangerous technologies that have the potential to be equally existential, from offensive cyber capabilities to bioweapons to lethal autonomous drones autonomous bots on AI, on social media and other places and platforms that we, within a year or two, will not be able to distinguish truly from human beings. And no. They're unlike in the 80s and the 90s, there is no architecture yet at all to try to contain those disruptive technologies from being proliferated. And that is an unacceptable threat to humanity as we exist on the planet today.
Now, 20 years ago, we used to think social, you know, all this connectedness available to regular people, right? And across national boundaries, importantly, would bring people more together and foster more democracy and more truth circulating in the world to counter authoritarian governments. Now we know it's at least more complicated than that. So what's on your roadmap for the power of that crisis to bring positive change?
Well, it's clearly a very different form of technology. 20 years ago, you're absolutely right. We were talking about the communications revolution. And you'll remember the New Yorker cartoon with the dog on the computer And it showed, it said on the internet, no one knows if you're a dog.
Yeah.
And that was very empowering to dogs on internet worldwide and citizens too. And that's how the wall came down. That's how we got the colored revolutions, the Arab Spring, Tunisia, Egypt, all these things. And, but today, of course, if you're on the internet, we know that you're a dog. We know what kind of a dog you are. And we know exactly where you do your doggy business. And we know what kind of people you are. And what that has done, the data revolution, is empowering a small number of states and corporations, states in countries like China and Russia and Iran, corporations in countries like the United States and Europe. And that really undermines civil society. It strengthens authoritarianism. It weakens democracies. So there's no question this is a very dramatic shift in how we think about the stability of different political systems and their sustainability. And of the crises I look at in the book, this is the one that is not sort of urgent and in front of us today, but you can see it coming like a train on the tracks. And absolutely, there are things we can do, things that we have already done, for example, in responding to, say, climate change, that if we apply them to disruptive technologies would make a meaningful difference in short order.
Yeah, and actually, maybe it's accurate to say Google and Apple and Russian intelligence know if you're a dog on the internet, but a lot of average people who see a lot of average tweets, which maybe come from Russian intelligence or some other place just intended to sow discord in the United States and make our system even more dysfunctional, you don't know if they're a dog.
That's
meaning
right.
If they're playing dirty tricks or if they're just a well-meaning individual spreading what they think is important.
And you just said something I think very profound that I want to tease out for a second. You said that Google or Russian intelligence. In other words, you just described two actors. One was a technology company. The other was a government. And you didn't distinguish between them. And I think that's exactly right. And if you want to look at the war in Ukraine, the fact is that Microsoft is playing just as much of a role, and Google and Elon Musk's SpaceX and Starlink, just as much in a role in defending the Ukrainians and undermining the Russians as any NATO ally is. And so what's interesting is that the response to this crisis is not going to be just about Beijing and Washington. It's also going to be about these private sector actors that are increasingly sovereign in the digital space.
Fascinating. Listeners, if you have questions for Ian Bremmer, they are welcome. Ian Bremmer, the global affairs expert at Columbia University, Time Magazine, the Eurasia Group, and more, with his new book, The Power of Crisis, How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World. Do you think any of today's crises can result in a better world? Or what would you like to ask Ian about his premise and his specifics? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or use Twitter for the good and tweet at Brian Lehrer. Ha. And again, the big three threats that you identify in the book that could potentially lead to positive change are disruptive technology that we just talked about, pandemics, and climate change. So let's turn next to the climate crisis. And I also mentioned in the intro the news out of the European Parliament this morning that gas and nuclear power have been declared officially green for government subsidy and loan rate purposes. There's the case for that move, and there's the case against on the continent that I think for context, Ian, we should say is generally seen as the most serious about climate, and that's Europe. So what exactly did the European Parliament do, and what is the context for that?
Well, the context is that they are under vastly greater immediate pressure because gas supply has been reduced significantly by Russia. They claim it's for technical reasons, but the reality, of course, is it's because of the war and a response to the sanctions. And nuclear energy, which the Europeans have been very reluctant to rely on, with the exception of the French, who get most of their energy electricity from nuclear domestically produced, they are now trying to move away from Russia as fast as humanly possible. And by the way, by next year, I would say that Russian gas is no longer going to be significant leverage on the major European economies.
Really?
So this is a near-term problem because the Europeans see that it is urgent. But what are they doing in response? They're doing everything in response. So they are stockpiling, so they have more reserves for the wintertime. They are improving efficiency for both industry and commercial use, consumer use. They are extending the life of existing nuclear plants that they were going to shut down. They're diversifying their gas supply. They are intensifying their reliance on renewable and green energy. Literally every lever they could pull, they will pull. In the near term, that will even mean things like more coal use, which is dirty. In the medium to long term, it will mean a faster transition past oil, past fossil fuels, to sustainable, renewable energy. And that is absolutely the use of a crisis to respond more effectively than otherwise we would have seen. And I see this happening all over the world. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if you were talking about climate change, you were largely an activist. You thought it was a nice idea, but you didn't take it urgently because it wasn't in front of you. It didn't affect you as much. That is changing dramatically. And even in this world of fake news and polarization, everyone in the world with power recognizes that we have already had 1.2 degrees centigrade of warming, that it is anthropogenic, man-caused, in other words, not a natural cycle. And we know the damage that it's causing around the world. We may not agree on exactly how we want to respond, but there's no longer meaningful fake science around climate. That is an enormously big deal. Just defining the problem in the same way, so that even if you don't trust each other, every action that's being taken is action that is largely moving towards a post-carbon future.
Yeah, even though a lot of people will look at it and say, we are moving incredibly slowly compared to the pace of warming, and that's an ongoing conversation in so many countries. By the way, how do you see the war in Ukraine now in the biggest possible context? I mean, even beyond the fundamental atrocity of the Russian invasion, which pretty much everybody agrees on, and how many people are dying or being made refugees as a result, and how this war might turn out. Is it even bigger than that for the future of humanity or the future of the West in the 21st century?
It is bigger than that, Brian. And I'm glad you framed it the way you did, because certainly everyone in NATO, like on climate change in the world, is on one side of this issue. Everyone agrees that there is no support for Putin. Everyone agrees that the Russians need to be punished, they need to be cut off, the Ukrainians were invaded unjustly, and that they need to be defended as strongly as possible. And the West is doing vastly more to defend Ukraine than anyone would have expected possible, certainly than Putin would have expected possible back on February 23rd before he launched the invasion. Now, the Ukrainians are losing territory. They are suffering immensely. This will be, you know, a generational issue and atrocity that will be seared in their national consciousness. And there is no minimizing that. But we should recognize that there is a much broader confrontation between Russia and NATO, a new Cold War with aspects of hot war that will be permanent as a consequence of the Russian invasion. I mentioned to you just a moment ago that as of next year, the Europeans will no longer really rely on the Russians for energy. That's never going to come back. And so the Russian leverage on Europe is at its maximum right now, and it's going away. Every day it's reducing, and Putin is highly aware of that. It's going to be a huge fight. NATO is getting much stronger. We've got two new countries that are joining, that are part of the accession process right now. Finland and Sweden never would have happened if it wasn't for invasion. The Germans are spending 2% of GDP. We've had how many presidents, Democrat and Republican, try to get the Germans to do that? They refused. But Putin and this crisis forced them to do it. We had the Japanese, the South Koreans, the Australians, the New Zealanders all show up at the NATO summit, increasingly talking about a global alliance in dealing with global threats, as opposed to the U.S. focuses on Europe, then it focuses on Asia. It's pivoting. It can't do one, can't do the other. Now, increasingly, it's aligned. Why? In response to this crisis. So absolutely, you want to broaden the aperture when you're talking about Russia-Ukraine and recognize that this was precisely what was necessary and so devastatingly sadly for the Ukrainians in order to get the United States and its allies to take seriously the fact that NATO was directionless, it was eroding, and people weren't recognizing the reality of 21st century security threats.
We'll continue in a minute. with Ian Bremmer, global affairs expert at Columbia University, Time Magazine, the Eurasia Group, and more, with his new book, The Power of Crisis, How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World. Ian, we have a full board of callers for you, including some really interesting ones, the way it looks. So we'll take some calls when we continue in a minute. What do people do on a hot summer morning in New York City? They call into a talk show to talk to Ian Bremmer. So we'll hear some of those voices right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Want to say thank you, by the way, to Arun Venkopal and Matt Katz for filling in the last couple of shows. We have Ian Bremmer, global affairs expert at Columbia University, Time Magazine, the Eurasia Group, and more, with his new book, The Power of Crisis, How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World. And Combies in South Orange, you're on WNYC with Ian Bremmer. Hi, Combies.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my question. I'm wondering, I'm Iranian-American, and the last time I was in Iran in 2015, I think Iran was just about or already had finished the nuclear deal, and it was a really great time in Iran. And Ian, my question is, do you see it in the future, anytime close, a reestablishment with the nuclear deal with Iran, or any sort of talks with the Iranian government? And how would that play out in the region right now? You know, I was thinking of sending a trip to Iran, but it's not the best time. When there was talks and the nuclear negotiations were good, it was really great. And people there were very optimistic. And now it kind of, doesn't feel that way. And the prince in Saudi Arabia doing his thing, and the region is very unstable. So do you think a new nuclear deal or talks with Iran can lower, I guess, the crisis threshold in the region? And how do you think that could affect the region? Thank you.
So did you see the movie Weekend at Bernie's?
I did not.
Yeah, so Brian, I'm sure, did. It's a little bit like that movie where, Bernie was dead all weekend, but everyone was trying to pretend he wasn't, because it was going to cause problems. That's kind of what's the case with the Iranian nuclear deal right now. It's dead. But the Iranians and the Americans have good reason to keep negotiations going and not formally kill it. The Iranians they've already pulled out the inspectors and the cameras from a lot of their critical facilities for nuclear uranium enrichment, for example. They have enough enriched uranium for at least two nuclear weapons at this point. The Americans, of course, pulled out of the deal under Trump. The Iranians have broken the terms of the deal because the sanctions have been snapped back against them. But if you were to say that the deal is over and it's broken, that will force the Americans to put even tougher sanctions on existing Iranian oil exports. And with oil at $105 right now and inflation the number one concern in the United States, nobody wants to do that. And with the Iranian economy not doing so well, they don't want to face that. So basically, I would say the talks are kind of on life support. The deal is essentially dead. But in the near term, at least the coming months, no one wants to admit to that. Is it a horrible time to go to Iran? I mean, I would say if as long as you, as a dual national, have literally nothing political in your background, no discussion on social media, nothing that the Iranian regime would potentially find problematic if they were to grab your phone and start looking through it, then I would say it's probably fine. But clearly, this is not a friendly, hopeful time between the two countries.
Another call, you were talking before about disruptive technology, social media, but all kinds of disruptive technology. And it looks like Brad in Manhattan wants to follow up on that. Hi, Brad. You're on WNYC with Ian Bremmer.
Hey. How are you? And I always enjoy Ian's commentary. There was a recent article in the New York Times Magazine called Brainwave, which is talking about implants in the head that would allow paraplegics and such to move objects or read or do other things. And that led me to think about a further disruptive technology. What happens when those implants become a natural extension of the regular person? What if we're, in effect, we can have artificial telepathy, artificial ability to move objects, to control things that way. What happens when that occurs and that technology decides to link up? It becomes like the Terminator or like the Matrix, and we have an artificial reality that could be imposed on us. There's a whole set of new kinds of disruptive technologies, which I think are implied by what you said, but was even snorting nanobots, let's say. What's going to happen? Those are even, things that are just one step away from all this. So take the internet to another level.
Thank you, Ian. Go ahead.
They're two steps away. How about one step away, which is what happens when young people, instead of being on their phones all the time, are actually spending a lot more time in the metaverse. And so they're much more immersed by, and their behaviors are much more affected by algorithms as opposed to by nature versus nurture. And I do think that reality, that already means that it's an extension of what you said. It is that their universe, the universe of our young people, is increasingly being defined not by family, friends, community, people that care about them, but rather by bots and algorithms that treat them as products and that are only interested in them and extracting profit and data. And I think that that's immensely disturbing and problematic for the future of a sustainable democracy. I think we are almost at that point. That technology exists already today. It is being rolled out, and we're doing very, very little to stop it.
Kathy on Staten Island, you're on WNYC with Ian Bremmer. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Oh, hello. I'm excited. Thank you, Brian and Ian, for taking my call. Longtime listener and admirer. So my question is about climate and Bitcoin. And while I was waiting, I thought of another question. I'll throw it on the table. You can answer it if you have time. The dumping of nuclear waste into the oceans. I'll take my answers off air. Thank you so much for taking my call. Be well.
Thank you very much. I mean, there's climate and new technology converging. Two of your three crises from the book, right? Because Bitcoin, if it's nothing if not new technology, but at the same time, there are implications for the climate crisis.
It is. I mean, of course, it uses a lot of electricity. The Bitcoin advocates talk about the fact that that's stranded electricity that is being used otherwise and wasted. So, I mean, places like in the interior of China, you have an enormous amount of hydropower that otherwise is literally going to waste. Instead, you can use it to mine Bitcoin. I don't have a problem with that argument. I wouldn't call myself an expert. But I also don't see this at anywhere close to the scale, at least yet, that it's driving climate as a conversation for me. For me, the more interesting point is the fact that there's so much investment in new technologies. And so much of it has been driven by China, that even if you are an ardent denier of climate change in the United States, even if you're completely focused on coal and oil and that's how you make your money, you have to recognize that in 20 years' time, if the Americans don't invest in new generation nuclear, don't invest in solar, don't invest in electric vehicles and in supply chain for rare earths, that the Chinese will become the next energy superpower and the Americans will be left behind. So, I mean, literally, even the hardline realpolitik types that don't care about climate understand that you have to, if you want to compete in a 21st century environment, you have to move and invest beyond traditional fossil fuels. And that it's precisely those dynamics that makes me much more optimistic late, very late, that humanity is responding. And so I think we're now on a pathway of 1.5 to 2.5 degrees of warming before we get to net zero carbon emissions. 10 years ago, a lot of people in the field thought it could be 3, 4, 5, even 6 degrees. There's a huge difference between 1.5 and 2.5. It's trillions and trillions of dollars. It's hundreds of millions of lives. But I think we should recognize just how much progress we have actually made kind of in spite of ourselves over the last 5-10 years.
Few tweets coming in, Ian, in response to our conversation about climate and different countries taking it seriously in different ways, or the debates about how serious even countries that proclaim to be serious are. Listener tweets, all the people in power across the world take climate change seriously, except the GOP, consequently the United States. Somebody else tweets, guest Ian Bremmer just compared the Iran nuclear deal to Weekend at Bernie's, and I'm in love. So you have a fan out there who who liked that analogy. And kind of related, somebody else tweets, appreciate guest, but wouldn't say anything mentioned is getting to a better world, just keeping worst possibilities at bay. Nuclear problem, terrible example, hasn't been solved at all, still huge role in geopolitics, still exists as a threat, simply avoided the worst so far. Your reaction to any of those?
Sure. Well, first of all, always appreciate people that are fans. But secondly, the GOP. It is true that the GOP has had less interest in pursuing a transition to renewable energy. And yet, if you ask me where we're seeing an enormous amount of investment in a post-carbon future, I'd focus on California. I'd also focus on Texas. And I look at just how much investment there's been in solar and wind in Texas and new
really?
To try to and also Elon Musk, of course, moving, you know, big plants for Tesla down there. Yeah. I mean, this is Texas wants to be a place where entrepreneurship and new technologies for the 21st century is being birthed. So does California. California has been doing it for a little bit longer with Silicon Valley, but Texas doesn't. They want that money. And, you know, I would say that outside of the federal government in Washington, which is doing virtually nothing because it's so polarized and everything is constrained by that, you still see the Americans moving. You see banks moving. A lot of bankers that are strongly GOP voters, and yet they're increasingly investing long term in ESG, in sustainable energy, because they understand that coal will not get them a return. And renewable energy will. I mean, I don't think Larry Fink from BlackRock, who is really the trailblazer here, he's not any more of a tree hugger than Goldman Sachs is. And yet he just wanted to make sure he got there before his competitors did, because he wants BlackRock to be the strongest possible institutional investor out there. So that's my point, is that this has kind of moved beyond ideology, beyond polarization, so much so that even when Trump became president, and he pulls the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord, something that every other leader around the world opposes, it turns out that the U.S. trajectory on carbon doesn't change under Trump, because bankers and CEOs and governors and mayors were all still committed to what was the obvious trajectory for the country.
And another example, like one you gave before on something else, about the private sector and public sector interacting to create change in one direction or another. We have about 2.5 minutes left, and I want to make sure we at least mention the third of the three crises you tackle in the book in the context of its potential for positive change, and that is pandemics plural. But has anything good in this long-term frame of your book come of the COVID pandemic as you see it?
Long-term, the good thing that's come is that Europe got stronger. They saw this as a reason to take more authority in Brussels, to bring Europe together in terms of acquisition and distribution of vaccines. So that Greece and Germany, poor and rich, getting them at the same time. They had a Marshall Plan, redistributing wealth from the wealthy countries to the poorer in terms of the kind of subsidies that they were getting, as everyone was concerned that the economies were being shut down. Globally speaking, the answer is no. And that's for the first few months, you felt like there was a good chance that we were going to use the pandemic effectively, because everyone was really scared. And they said, OK, we need to figure this stuff out. But in relatively short order, the Chinese got complacent because of their lockdowns, and they didn't learn any lessons as the pandemic changed. And now they've got all these problems from zero COVID. And in a relatively short order, the Americans felt like, wow, we've got vaccines now. We're so fast at that. And it's not it became politicized. And so you got red state versus blue state. So no, the funny thing, the horrible thing, is that the pandemic turned out to be not a big enough crisis for us to learn any sustainable lessons, unlike the Russian invasion of Ukraine, unlike climate change.
Wow. Ian Bremmer, global affairs expert at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, a Time Magazine columnist, president of the Erasure Group consulting firm, and his media outlet, G-Zero Media, and now author of a new book, The Power of Crisis, How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World. It also hit the New York Times bestseller list the other day. Ian, thanks for sharing so much of it with us. Really, really interesting, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks for being back on. Brian, I'll talk to you soon.